And now, the Stanford Storytelling Project presents as a special addendum to the Apocalypse Show, an interview with Alexander Rose.
We began this show with the premise that the world as we know it will indeed end one day. But all this apocalypse business begs the question, well, then what? What can last? What will survive in the long run? This is the kind of thing that the Long Now Foundation has been thinking about for a while. Headquartered at Fort Mason in San Francisco, all of their projects are set within a 10,000-year framework.
The idea was to do some projects, some very long-term projects, as examples for long-term thinking and long-term thinkers.
This is Alexander Rose, Executive Director of the Long Now Foundation. They have several projects in the works, and if you've heard of one, it's probably their 10,000-year clock.
The first project that the Long Now Foundation was started around was that of to build a 10,000-year all-mechanical clock. And that idea came from computer designer Danny Hillis, who had been designing some of the fastest supercomputers in the world, and realized more and more that the space of slower was being underserved, and so designed basically the slowest computer in the world, the 10,000-year clock.
They also host a monthly lecture series in San Francisco, where philosophers, artists, inventors, linguists, and other academics explore ideas of deep time. Whenever I go to these lectures, I always get the sense that the Long Now audience is a secret society of people who are at once skeptical and hopeful about the future of humankind. It's sort of ironic, really, that the people thinking about longevity, continuity, investment, and building for the faraway future are actually the best people to talk to if you want to know what to do in the short term, when history takes a turn, society, at least as we know it, snaps, and everything goes south.
We do know, in looking back at the last 10,000 years, that there is no civilization that has lasted 10,000 years. 10,000 years is basically how long man has been altering his environment to fit himself versus reacting to that environment. And so that's why we chose that time frame. It's when agriculture basically started after the last ice age. So anything that we design, we make assumptions that technology may drop off, that knowledge may be lost. That's the reason we're doing things like making it mechanical. We design all of our objects in a way for archaeologists to find and try and make as little assumptions about them as possible. And that's why it's not a big electronic clock. If you found an electronic object and your technology had dropped, or even if it hasn't, if you arrive there and it has a digital readout or something like that, there's nothing on. There's no way to determine how it worked, how the microprocessors worked. It's very opaque. So with mechanical objects, you can piece together how they worked. In fact, one of the oldest astronomical clock examples in the world, or the oldest, is the Antikythera device, which was found at the bottom of the Mediterranean near Greece. And it predates all other clocks of its type by almost a millennium, including all the gear work inside. And no one knows too much about it, but we do know that it was through recreations, we know because it was mechanical, we've determined it was a clock that tracked the planets and the eclipses and moon and things like that.
Designing for the 10,000-year future is no easy task. A lot can happen in 10,000 years. Alexander said that if we look at the great monuments that survive from the past today, the thing that interferes most with their preservation is actually human behavior. We seem to have an innate scavenging instinct. Up to now, we are at least as good at deconstruction as we are at construction. Things, especially valuable things, are likely to get taken apart for what some might call creative reuse. Maybe then, the best way to withstand the test of time is to just keep creating your monument, even if you've created it before, and as time and people take their toll, to keep creating it over and over.
We also look at history a lot. So our best examples are looking at buildings that have lasted for over a millennia or several centuries and what has happened to them. And there's a lot of very interesting examples throughout history. And some of the ones that we often recognize are things like the pyramids. Now, the pyramids were built and then raided and actually scraped of their outer most beautiful stonework only within a few generations of their completion. But they're still the pyramids. We still have them. They're iconic. So people kind of thought they stole the most valuable part of the pyramids, which was the gold inside and the marble on the outside to build the mosques of Cairo. But we still have them. So that's an interesting method where you allow a certain amount of theft to happen. Similarly, the Taj Mahal, when it was built, was encrusted all the way throughout with little gems. And when it was sacked for the last time by Britain, instead of burning the building down, which they did to a lot of other buildings, or destroying it, they spent a long time prying all these jewels out of the walls. So they felt as though they had stolen the value of the building, but we still have the building, it's still beautiful, and the gems are actually the least important part of that. So one strategy is to put things out that people can steal to make them feel as though they have taken the value of the object, even though it still is there. And I would say over the long term, our biggest danger is the thieves, the people melting down all the metal for the next war effort or whatever it is. My favorite example, and one that involves humans, is the temple at Issei in Japan. By all accounts, it's been around for at least a millennium, and by some accounts, for almost two millennium. And it's made of rice paper and wood and thatch, very ephemeral materials. But the way it's lasted is that every 20 years, they build a brand new one right next to the current one in these alternating sites. And so every 20 years, which is basically one generation, a master carpenter teaches the next master carpenter how to build this Shinto temple. And it's allowed Shinto religion to kind of last through all the other religions that have swept through Japan by this very physical reminder of an act of rebuilding the temple. So I like that one, that continuity of humanity has allowed it to work. And that's very much the way we're building the clock, is that we expect a certain amount of maintenance. We expect people to wind it. We also expect that they might not wind it for a long time, and we designed in ways for it to recover from those kind of situations.
In many respects, the Long Now's thinking is apocalyptic thinking. After a civilizational collapse, what will survive? And in hindsight, what will our descendants think of us? The 10,000-year clock is still in the planning phases. After the clock is built, it's just going to sit there, ticking. I asked Alexander what value the clock of the Long Now would have if someone stumbles upon it 10,000 years from now.
Well, I think a common scenario that we run internally is, what if we found the clock today? And in a sense, things like the Antikythera device are that. It's a 2,000-year-old astronomical clock. It's not monument in scale. It's a little desktop thing. But by finding an object like that, you do realize, you get a sense of values of the people that created it. And I would say that we hope that if someone found it, that they would get a sense that the people of that past cared about that future. So, I mean, I think that's what we want to convey to those people. But the reality of this project is it's very much about the present. I mean, it's an audacious project. I mean, it's difficult and almost crazy. So the idea is to inspire people, new myths, new stories, stories that people tell to other people and say, well, these crazy people are building this 10,000-year clock. Why don't we be conservative and make a 100-year plan for our company? Would be a success in our minds.
Maybe the 10,000-year clock is preparing the way for the best of all possible post-apocalyptic worlds. After a serious crash, this would be a great way to approach society, designing for the future rather than just the present. Could a new deep-time paradigm heal the rift between form and function that plagues our material culture today? Should everything be thought of in the long term? Alexandra pointed out that we don't have to wait until after a huge crash to start thinking in terms of the long now, and maybe not everything should be thought of in the long term.
You know, there's fashion and art and parts of technology that, by definition, have to stay short-term and fast and crazy in order to feel fresh and interesting and new. And I think that there's parts of always knowing your past that is debilitating. Choosing the things that are worth thinking long-term about. This was something that we worked on early on. And Brian Eno and Stuart Brands, two of our founding board members, came up with this diagram of these different layers of human time. These layers moving at different speeds, and the slowest and longest being nature, and the fastest being, you know, fashion and technology on the outside, and in between are layers like commerce and governance and infrastructure and things like that. So finding where people skip those layers in projects is usually where problems occur. So, for instance, if you are harvesting old growth redwoods in order to pay off a debt of Pacific Lumber to get back your quarterly profits, these are the types of things where you know you are making a big mistake. And when you can't invest in a project like education or hunger because the return on that investment comes back later than a political cycle will make it a benefit to the current political system, you know that there's a problem. So these are the types of things that we are looking for and want to point out. Not to say that everything should move slower necessarily.
Alexander Rose is the executive director of the Long Now Foundation, and you can find out more about their projects online at longnow.org. I'm Bonnie Swift for the Stanford Storytelling Project.